This is the second day of this December 2010 four-day session. And we'll resume reading from a book called Zen Essence, which is an anthology of various great Chinese masters' teachings, selections from their teachings. Yesterday we read from those of Yuan Wu, and today we'll read from those of Zen Master Foyan. His dates are 1067 to 1120. Let's see if there's anything here in the back. There are brief biographical sketches, not biographical, but have a synopsis of the style of teaching of each teacher. Nope, there's nothing that we won't get to in the selections themselves. Once there was a monk who specialized in the Buddhist precepts and had kept to them all his life. Once when he was walking at night, he stepped on something. It made a squishing sound, and he imagined he had stepped on a frog. This caused him no end of alarm and regret because of the Buddhist precept against taking life. And when he finally went to sleep that night, he dreamed that hundreds of frogs came to him demanding his life. So the monk was terribly upset. But when morning came, he went back and looked at what he had stepped on, and it was just an eggplant, an overripe eggplant. And at that moment, his feeling of uncertainty suddenly stopped, and for the first time, he realized the meaning of the saying that there is no subjective world. Objective. Whoa. There's no objective world. Then he finally knew how to practice Zen. In modern terms, we would say neuroscientists would say that that what we call reality is really our interpretation of it, which doesn't mean that each of us has a different interpretation. There is a collective interpretation, a consensus of what reality is, but that still it's all about how we interpret the data of our senses, how we interpret what we see, hear, smell, taste, feel, and think, the six Buddhist senses, the five ordinary senses plus the sixth thinking as the sixth. We get a we get our own introduction to this in Sesshin, where with Makyo, side effects, these mental, emotional, unusual sense impressions that we get when we're doing a lot of zazen, hallucinations and other things, and we, little by little, we come to realize that it's true that what we call the world, which is such an artificial thing to think that there's a world out there that we're not part of. What we call the world or reality or truth is all filtered through mind. This is, of course, a fundamental tenet or understanding of the Dharma. Or as we say in Affirming Faith in Mind, for things are things because of mind. And then in Zen we also acknowledge the other half, as mind is mind because of things. And these two are relative, and both at source, in their essence, are empty. If we allow this truth about reality, if we really accept it, if we really recognize that mind determines our whole experience of reality and our way of understanding it and seeing it, then we can very easily see how essential meditation is, a life of meditation. The key thing is to understand the mind. When we understand the mind, we understand reality. Because you can't separate them. To make this less abstract, consider in the realm of relationships, any kind of relationships, your relationships with your co-workers, with your colleagues, relationships with your family, with your partner, how much of the difficulties that arise in relationships because of the way we are interpreting what's happening. Our conditioning. And what Zazen does, and especially what Sesshin does, is it exposes exposes this conditioning and how much it affects our happiness or unhappiness. And luckily, we're not stuck with our conditioning. Our conditioning, all of these psychological forces that cause one person to react differently than other people in situations, all of our conditioning is in flux. We're not just stuck with some fixed baggage that we can't do anything about. That's the whole point, of course, of our practice. Is the first step is to see it, see what's going on in our mind, see how we can, how subjectively we apprehend the world, and then once we've seen some of these forces, these elements in our mind that cause us suffering. Once we've seen them, then that's more than half the battle. It's just seeing them. Because once we see the filter, then we have a whole new perspective on it. Reality. It's waking up to the fact that there is a filter through which we filter experience. In Sesshin, everything is stripped down to the basics in our daily schedule, and things are very simple. So we don't have a lot of ways of getting entangled in relationships and exchanges with people, where we maintain silence, and yet there are still opportunities. We will find a way in what little contact we have with people, we'll find a way to have things arise that get in the way. certainly in Doksan, Doksan can leave us with impressions that are confusing or even upsetting. There's a good medium in which to see our stuff as it arises and after it has arisen. And of course, I'm speaking as someone who went to Doksan as a student for some 15 or some years. I know the kind of stuff that can come up: the anger, disappointment, idealism that can get involved with working with a teacher. And this is one of the benefits of Doksan: is okay, let's get in under the hood and see what's going on here with the mind and how it reacts. Not just reacting in Doksan, but all of that period leading up to Doksan, the round before, or the rounds before going to Doksan, how the mind works, and then as well the rounds after Doksan, how we can chew on things and waste time dwelling in what was said or done in Doksan. And then there's the work period, where we can also find our buttons pushed by those with whom we're working, especially possibly the supervisor. It's all grist for the mill. Now, the ignorant person, the ordinary person, let's say, when they get into any kind of adverse reactions to people, they'll just find fault with the other. Oh, why does that person have to be that way? Why does that person have to talk that way? It's all on the other person. What is so radical about meditation practice like Zen is that's not our job to change other people. Because our experience is filtered through our own mind, so it's our own mind we want to look at when we get into difficulties. That's really what facing the wall represents. It means looking into one's own mind, turning the mind around, rather than getting caught in observations about the surface of the wall, which is a way of understanding, you know, the other people. We turn the mind back and see what's going on with our own reactions, our own stuff. And this is what is so liberating, is realizing that it's not so much what's going on out there, quote unquote, out there. It's how we respond to circumstances and to other people, which is a function of our own conditioning. Now Foyan then at another time says, "Why do you not understand your nature when it is inherently there? There is not much to Buddhism. It just requires getting to the essential." This is quite a compelling question. Why do you not understand your nature when it's right here? It's not like something we have. We are our nature. So why don't we understand it? He goes on, We do not teach you to annihilate random thoughts, suppress body and mind, shut your eyes, and say, this is Zen. Zen is not like this. We do not teach you to annihilate random thoughts. We're not trying to do anything with our thoughts. This has to be clear. To really get somewhere in Zen practice, we've got to get this point. We're not trying to do anything with our thoughts. What we're trying to do is keep our attention on our practice, the breath, or the koan, shikantaza. Thoughts are not the object of our work. Thoughts are just this extraneous thing that's going on all the time, because that's the way the mind functions. It generates thought activity. But that's not our business. We're not trying to do anything with the thoughts. We're certainly not trying to stop them. We're not trying to shift them or identify them or fight them. We don't want to do anything with the thoughts. Let's let them be. Just let them be. But keep the attention on the breath or the practice, whatever the practice is. You can do both. In basketball, when a player is taking a foul shot, a free shot, and standing there before the basket, and there are maybe, 5,000 people who are screaming crazy stuff and waving things right in the visual field of the shooter, anything they can to make them distracted. He doesn't have to have all that stop in order to sink the basket. He just has to really have his attention on the basket. He doesn't say, well, there's nothing much I can do now. Look at all this noise. I'm just going to have to wait until everyone is quiet. I'm sorry, but how can I do this? No. He doesn't have to do anything about all that noise and commotion. He just needs to keep his attention riveted on the basket. The koan, the breath. He's aware. He's not blind and deaf. He's aware of what's going on around him, but it's like it's not happening. He's so absorbed in the basket, what he's got to do at that moment, that it's like all that noise is no noise. All that activity is no activity. As Hakuin says, our thought now being no thought. Our thought now being no thought. We do not teach you to annihilate random thoughts, suppress body and mind, shut your eyes and say, this is Zen. Same thing with the eyes. We're not trying to shut out the world. That basketball player doesn't have to plug up his ears or shut his eyes. It's all attention. Where is our attention? Or rather, to put it more clearly, where are we directing our attention? Because we do have a choice as to where we're directing it. That's our freedom. That's the element of our freedom. The way in which we are not free, the way in which we are bound is all that conditioning that we're dragging along with us all the time. But that's just half the equation. The other half is our choice, our freedom, and where we're directing our attention. He continues, or not continues, this is another selection. It is as though you have an eye that sees all forms but does not see itself. This is how your mind is. Its light penetrates everywhere and engulfs everything, so why does it not know itself? One of Fo Yan's great predecessors, Yunmen, put it this way. The mind's light is everywhere, but when you try to see it, you cannot. Everything is dark. Where is the mind's light? And then he answered himself, the tower gateway, the temple storeroom. Its light penetrates everywhere and engulfs everything, so why does it not know itself? Well, this is not a question we want to spend any time on when we're working on a breath or another koan. The question is, what is mu? What am I? What is it? Why questions invite analysis. The last thing we want to be doing in our sitting is analyzing anything. As soon as you rationalize, it is hard to understand Zen. You will have to stop rationalizing before you will get it. Well, I think here rationalization here means more broadly it means to use your discriminating mind. It doesn't mean just that definition of coming up with an excuse for something, but It's as long as we are engaged with the discriminating mind in Zazen, then we will fail to see what is beyond the discriminating mind. It's really a very simple practice. It's not complicated. Every time you notice that you're engaged with a discriminating mind, go back to the practice. How do you know when you're engaged with the discriminating mind? Well, unfortunately, a lot of the time, we don't know. We don't notice. There's discrimination going on, but we're so involved in the activity of the mind that we don't have the awareness that we're discriminating. So the first thing is to notice when we're caught in discriminating. Any time there's any kind of two-ness in the mind, that's the work of the discriminating mind. Two-ness of any kind. So often people come to Doksan and they ask, is it this or is it that? Should I be doing this or should I be doing that? And sometimes it's a good practical question to get out of the way. But all too often it's unnecessary. That's not what the practice is about, is making this decision of whether it's this or that. Here's a simple one. He says, Zen enlightenment is as if you had been away from home for many years and then you suddenly see your father in town. You know him right away, without a doubt. There's no need to ask anyone else whether he is your father or not. Well, this is recognition. Which is kind of a neat word for awakening. It's when we think of it as recognizing, we're processing something in a new way and seeing it as it is. This state that he's referring to, where he says Zen enlightenment, this is real, real solid, deep enlightenment. For lesser experiences, little awakenings, getting through one's first koan, usually it's not so crystal clear. So you feel sometimes, okay, yeah, I feel a little different, but then I'm still reacting this way and reacting that way, and I still have this bad habit, and so is this really, really anything, any real shift in my practice? But if one can discard those thoughts and just continue to work arduously on one's practice and keep it up for years and years and years, then such questions, such doubts evaporate. And the whole matter is sort of beside the point. Awakening, non-awakening, it's just the work. Wherever we are in this long, long path, there we've got work to do. We got a lot of work to do. Dogen says somewhere, if you think you've gone all the way, keep going. You only get it when you're halfway. Heard just recently from a woman who'd been given up for adoption when she was newborn, It was she's born out of wedlock. Her father, her biological father, actually, had paid the mother to have an abortion, and he just washed his hands of her, and the mother didn't go through with it. Then she raised the child, and the father had no idea that he had a daughter. And then when the daughter was 50 or so, she had some medical issue, and for which she really wanted to find out whether her father, her biological father, had the same vulnerability. So she found a way, I don't remember, she found a way to get in touch with him through a lawyer. She didn't want to be seen as a gold digger, so she found some indirect way and just wanted to know about the medical thing. And he was suspicious and wanted her to take a test, but it wasn't necessary. She said as soon as their eyes met, as soon as he saw her, he knew like that it was his daughter. Age 50. And then just the epilogue to the story is that then he completely took her into his life, and it was a wonderful reunion. Here's a little selection called that the editor, Thomas Cleary, calls Doubt and Understanding. Foyan says, if you want to understand Zen, you must question inwardly to study it deeply. If you question deeply, transcendental knowledge appears. Questioning is really not particularly suited to breath practice, but it is the element of questioning with a koan can be really decisive. It's really what distinguishes a koan from a breath practice or a koan from a mantra practice is the element of questioning. I've often said this, so I won't go into this at any length, but there are people who are working on a koan, but find that they don't really have the questioning. It feels forced to question the koan. And what I tell such people is, all right, if it feels contrived, don't try to force yourself to question and feel like it's insincere. Just be thoroughly absorbed in the koan, even without the questioning. And then, at a certain point of absorption, you should find that the whole thing becomes puzzling, perplexing. So in the case of a koan like Mu, when you reach a certain intimacy with it, a degree of merging with it, then the whole subject-object paradigm gets very mystifying. If I'm Mu, then who's questioning whom or what? What is this? What is Mu? That's when one's practice can really take flight, is when the questioning bites into you and it's doing the work. You no longer have any choice because the questioning just keeps gnawing at you. But until that point, it's nearly as powerful to just be completely, just make every effort to be absorbed in the koan, even without the questioning. I'm convinced that someday neuroscientists will find a way to see how the brain lights up, the area of the brain that lights up when one is questioning, as compared to other cognitive functions. There's something unique about questioning as a mental function. The genius of questioning a koan is that you can't hold on to your notions, your ideas, and question at the same time. That's the nature of questioning. Is you're letting go of your ideas. Another selection. The minute you fixate on the idea that this is it, you are immediately bound hand and foot and cannot move around anymore. This is just to the point of what we were saying about questioning. You can't say this is it while you're questioning. The two are mutually exclusive. It's just the nature of questioning. It won't let you settle into any conclusions as long as you're questioning. Well, you can question mechanically and hold on to your notions about things and people, but to genuinely question, sincerely question, that's different. He goes on, so as soon as it is given this recognition, or this idea of this is it, nothing is right, whatever it may be. If you don't fixate on recognition, you can still be saved. That is, if you don't get, don't let these ideas lodge, if you don't get bound to your ideas, then there's still hope. It's like making a boat and outfitting it for a 1,000-mile journey to a treasure trove. If you drive a stake and tie the boat to it before you jump in and start rowing, you can row till kingdom come and still be on the beach. You see the boat waving this way and that, and you think you're on the move, but you've never gone a single step. This points to the underlying principle here with this questioning and not settling for ideas about the way the world is. The basic principle is non-abiding, non-attachment to ideas. This is where we get into all of our trouble, is when we attach to ideas. That's when the mind closes up shop. And the various practices, whether they involve questioning or not, breath practice is the same thing, is all, they're just all ways, methods of reaching a state of non-abiding, non-clinging to mental objects. This non-abiding is freedom. We're open. It's a state of openness. And it's in this openness of non-abiding, this is where we are most receptive to all of the sense impressions of the world. This is where we can take in things in a new, fresh way and have the mind turn about. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.